Taking Stock.
Brought to you by PwC.
This is News Talk.
Well, hello and welcome to Taking Stock. I'm Susan Hayes Culleton, and this is the show that looks at business and economics from a wider perspective. So coming up on today's show, as we increasingly spend more and more on our pets, we look at the economics of owning a cat or dog. And dealonomics, when is the best time to sell your business? Plus, is NAMA Ireland's bad bank that's leaving a good legacy? Now, you can email the show, takingstock@newstalk.com, or you can message me on socials at Susan Hayes Culleton on LinkedIn, Instagram, X and Blue Sky. Now, I have a little bit of a cold today, so please do excuse me if I sound a little bit different. But I do want to start off by explaining to you what the concept of an externality is today. Okay, so it's basically the side effect of an activity that affects someone else who isn't part of the decision. So let me start off with an example, right? So my office is on the campus of TU Dublin. And that, of course, is a university that's set up to educate students and produce research and provide for the academic community. But the externality here is that there's lots of families that can use the park area, like couples and friends and dog walkers, etc. So a positive externality of the university is a lovely public space for the entire community. That's the side effect of the activity that affects somebody else who isn't part of the decision. Now, the reason that we talk about externalities in economics, and by the way, they can, of course, be positive and negative, is because people are often indirectly affected by decisions, economic and otherwise, and it's important to factor these things into things like government and decision and household planning as well. So hopefully, the next time you're making a decision, you'll think about the externalities. So a new report from global law firm Taylor Wessing, which analysed 896 cross-border deals between 2018 and 2024, shows that confidence remains high across the mergers and acquisitions landscape despite geopolitical pressures. But it also highlights that critical risks are still being missed, with the likes of talent retention and customer continuity being regularly overlooked, despite their impact on post-deal value creation. So on the line to discuss the results of the survey and wider M&A trends is head of Taylor Wessing Ireland, Adam Griffith. And joining me in studio is Áine Den, who co-founded the sales tech business Altify, which was successfully acquired at the end of 2019. First of all, you're both very welcome to Taking Stock.
Thanks, Susan.
Great. Well, Adam, we'll start off with you. Now, the report does make interesting reading, and one of the findings that jumped out at me was that 79% of dealmakers say growth potential is routinely overestimated and integration challenges are the most underestimated risk in cross-border deals. Now, this isn't really new news, really, Adam. Like, why do businesses miss these key points?
Yeah, that's really interesting, isn't it? I think... But my perception is you bundle that into the human factors part of deal making, and also that slightly very human quality for not finishing out tasks once you feel that the most material aspect is complete. So I think, to be honest, sometimes transactions are reduced too heavily to a sort of piece of spreadsheet analysis. And there's a lack of attention into cultivating the management and leadership part of the business effectively.
But are people just too excited about getting the deal done then? Is that the issue?
Yeah, no, I was thinking about how to express this morning. I think in some respects it's not dissimilar from buying a really fancy new piece of technology for your home, or for example, buying an electric car, and you're very excited about the prospect of having that new tech, and you're excited about the prospect of the cost savings that you can achieve with it. But if I was to take my own example, I can tell you that I bought the car, very excited about that, but my diligence and execution in getting a charger fitted and working my way through the bureaucracy of getting a grant repaid, that was sadly lacking. If you see what I mean. So I think sometimes with transactions, it's a very clear culminating moment to which loads of attention has been paid by a huge number of different people in both in-house and by advisors. And then very much sometimes there's a sense of that's done now and we'll move on.
Well, Áine, what's been your experience of going through these transactions?
I suppose I've experienced it from both sides. So we made two acquisitions along the way and then we were subsequently acquired. And I love that the idea of the human factor, Adam. I think that's a great word. when we did the acquisition, we were all over the team and the people that were coming on board with us. And we knew that they were key to the success. So we engaged with them very early on and we continued to work with them. When we were acquired ourselves, I mean, I was leaving the business within a quarter, like at the end of the financial year. But I spent that quarter going and visiting every single one of our customers to make sure that we had that continuity of customers, because the deal might be done, but you want your team to thrive, you want your company to thrive, you want your customers to thrive. So that's what we focused on for that quarter. And obviously, in the build-up to any acquisition, we had been very focused on the readiness and on making sure that the team was in place and the team that were going to carry the business forward were also in place. And I think I mentioned before in due diligence, like every customer that Upland spoke to mentioned one of our team by name. So they said, oh, Martin was brilliant. Tammy and the team really listened to us. So Upland already had a sense of the team that they were going to be working with. And I think that was really important.
Well, it sounds like that's super important here, particularly based on what we're seeing in this report. But it makes sense, Anya. It really does. Can I also go on to ask you something else about, first of all, your business was acquired at the end of 2019, like I mentioned at the beginning. And the report says that talent retention and customer continuity are often overlooked. You've spoken there about the customer continuity, but how did you make sure that the talent wanted to stay put? As you said, you were going within the quarter.
Yeah, and it's very important to realise that, you know, once the company's been acquired, you have no control. I hear founders all the time say, well, what I want to happen is I want that person to be promoted and I want this. It's not in your control anymore. It's in the control of the acquirer now. So all you can do is do the groundwork in advance. So, I mean, over the previous couple of years, we had gone on a number of, you know, we'd renamed, we'd launched a new category, we'd hired a new CEO, we'd built up a new exec management team that was largely San Jose based. You know, there was an awful lot of preparedness. And as part of our own process, we had identified who within the management team would continue to be the GM of this particular division within the larger ship going forwards. So, again, you have to be intentional about it. You have to do the groundwork. I think, you know, Taylor Wessing referred to it as just doing the housekeeping, and that's what you have to do.
Well, Adam, looking at this from a broader perspective, 78% of your respondents said that cross-border deals lead to a more productive economy. Now, I was thinking I could understand why the people who would be answering this survey would say that. But can you explain to me, from a productivity benefits point of view, why would the economy benefit more from M&A as distinct to simply the business, both the acquirer and the acquiree?
Yeah, I don't want to sort of get too wonky about it. And I have asked myself this question as well. I think it comes slightly towards that sense of vertical and horizontal integration in the sense that you have different businesses in different jurisdictions that are equipped in different parts of the vertical or horizontal market, depending on how you fit it together. And to take Anya's example, there was obviously a perception that the combined aggregated strength of Upland with AlphaSci would create a whole that was greater than the sum of the parts. And it's the extent to which you buy into that sort of 2 + 2 = 5 type equation when you're combining businesses, provided that you can navigate the pitfalls identified where, you know, cost synergies are overestimated and talent retention is underestimated and customer continuity is impacted by that lack of talent. I think that M&A can effectively create better jigsaws if it's executed properly. And from a very simple and reductive basis, you know, Ireland's position as a huge net beneficiary of foreign direct investment, I think it would be very difficult to argue that Ireland's productivity hasn't been massively improved and increased through being open to cross-border M&A and the ability to then access, you know, broader global markets.
So, Anya, if it is the case that it is foreign direct investment, and so it sounds like, Adam, what you're saying is that it's the quantum of M&A that happens is distinct to simply that it happens is a defining factor in that finding. Do you think, Anya, that M&A increases productivity in a business and therefore in the local economy?
I don't know about productivity. When I read that point, what struck me was that obviously, you know, when there is an M&A, there's equity and cash released, and then that gets invested into other companies, other Indigenous Irish companies. So from a local perspective, I can see how that would work. And also, you know, when we acquired a company in Atlanta, we put a lot of money then into that community and into offices and employees and community projects within Atlanta. So I'm not sure about the overall picture, but I can see how, you know, it definitely changes where the money goes, where the money flows.
Well, Áine, it certainly sounds like you knew what you were doing well. And where do you learn about this? Was it that you had spoken to people who had been through this already? Was it a training course you had gone on? Was it that you were part of a wider management team that had been here before? Like, if people are listening today and saying, how does she know all this? Where do you get the knowledge? So, apart from experience, of course.
Yeah, no, a lot of experience, a lot of curiosity. I mean, I had come up through the corporate sector and I had learned an awful lot of the skills that would stand me in good stead during that phase. But honestly, the network as well, you know, you speak to other companies who've been down a similar road and they'll be very generous with their experience and with their learnings. And we also learned from our customers. I mean, you know, we were an Irish company, but we were selling to Fortune 1000 customers. So we saw what they did every day and we learned from that.
Right. And a lot of what you're saying sounds quite US focused. So Adam, I want to go to the geography of value section of the report. And it said the top three markets by deal volume were the US, the UK and Nordics. Now, the US, I think nobody would be surprised at that. The UK, again, quite an investment focused culture. And the Nordics, yeah. We probably have lesser of an understanding of what they're like here on the ground. But why do you think the EU doesn't even make the top three here?
There's clearly very strong underlying economic strength in those jurisdictions. But I think there may be a link with another finding of the report that regulation is typically seen by a significant proportion of deal makers as a critical barrier to success. And that, I think, just to be clear on that, I don't think it's the existence of regulation. It's how it's implemented and how quickly it can be navigated. Because, you know, interestingly, UK and US are identified as jurisdictions where regulation is actually seen as a positive. And I think what people are saying there is, you know, an equivalent level of regulation may exist in the UK, you know, brackets, despite what Brexiteers may have sought to achieve, close brackets. But those regimes are being overseen in a really positive, assertive way to ensure that they're not a barrier. And I think part of the way that you have to view a report like this is you have to challenge perception versus reality. And a lot of US deal makers, for example, will see France as quite a friction heavy jurisdiction in which to do their business. But I can actually say from genuine experience of leading deals that have a strong French nexus, actually, French institutions are genuinely quick and responsive and execute well. So I wonder whether fundamentally the EU, in addressing, you know, with this wave of regulation that they're introducing, with good intentions around, you know, digital services, digital markets, digital operational resilience, NIS2, which goes to cybersecurity, you know, a wave of new law. They're not doing a fantastic public relations job in expressing that they're trying to deliver liberty through order, in the sense that, you know, if everybody understands what their obligations are and they can be overseen quickly by regulators,
so could
they don't
I,
have to be a barrier.
So what I say then, if I was to summarise what you've just said there, Adam, is that there is a perception of greater regulation being a barrier than exists, and the EU needs to be more, the European Union environment needs to be more friendly towards M&A.
Well, I don't think it's unfriendly. It needs to be more assertive in its public relations battle, really, in the sense of saying that that regulation is not a barrier because it's overseen properly and in an adult way. And I think a lot of the broadsheet press has been banging a drum that, you know, it's going to be an increasingly difficult place to do business. But that's not my experience.
Okay. Anya, you might remember I interviewed you a couple of years ago at the Venture Capital Conference on stage, and I was asking you about the difference between Irish companies and your experience in the US. And something you said that I always remembered was that Irish companies don't have the rigor and cadence in terms of their sales in comparison to US companies. And this can have a big impact then on the multiple that they get or the selling price. Have your thoughts changed since then?
That was probably quite a sweeping statement. I'm not sure it's an Irish versus US thing. But I mean, I've spent the last 5 years advising companies that are beginning to scale, early stage scale. Yes, sales cadence still remains a problem, but actually it's just one of those fundamentals that needs to be in place around that early scaling journey and that setting up for success from day one. So that's really, I mean, my previous mission was all about empowering the next generation of salespeople, but now I am on a mission to help more founder-led companies be successful and be successful by setting up correctly from the start across all aspects. Because your valuation, yes, reliability of sales numbers is going to be key, but so is reliability around your employees, retaining that talent, your customer retention, your NPS scores. Like, there's a lot of numbers, there's a lot of elements that all need to come together that impact that valuation. A lot of moving pieces or levers, as we like to say.
And Anya, as we come to the end of our conversation today, if somebody's listening today and thinking, you know, I wonder, could I sell my company? Maybe they haven't thought about it before, or maybe they have been thinking about it in recent times. What should they be asking themselves to determine whether to move forward with that thought?
I think there's an energy question. You have to ask yourself, you know, what age are you? Do you have the energy that you want to continue to grow this? Do you want to take this to the ultimate place? Or do you want to take it to a particular point and then hand it over? But the most important thing is, are you systems thinking? Like, an awful lot of initial growth is founder driven. And what it actually needs to be is system driven, but founder led. So just make sure that you're taking yourself out of the equation, that you have a strong management team, and that the company could flourish as part of a bigger organisation.
Well, Anya Den and Adam Griffith, thank you so much indeed for joining us today. Really appreciate your time. This is Susan Hayes-Cullerton here on Taking Stock on News Talk. And after the break, we look at the controversial history of NAMA. Now, you're very welcome back to News Talk's Taking Stock. I'm Susan Hayes-Cullerton. And over the years, NAMA has been both praised for averting a deeper financial crisis and criticised for its handling of assets, transparency and long-term social impact, with the question of whether NAMA was ultimately a success. And that is a topic of ongoing debate among economists, policymakers and the public. But it's important that we discuss it here on Taking Stock. And in order to do so, we're now joined by John Burns, Deputy Business Editor with the Irish Independent. John, you're very welcome to Taking Stock.
Morning, Susan.
Now, let's go back to 2009, when NAMA began. The whole idea was to create a bad bank, clear out toxic assets and also get the banks lending again. So just to jog our listeners' memories, some of these will be painful. 74.4 billion of loans was then acquired for 31.8 billion. And this represented a 57% haircut. So, John, how did NAMA influence the recovery of the Irish property and banking sectors post-2008, in your view?
Yes, and the other interesting part of those stats is that the market value of those loans was actually only 26 billion at that time. So NAMA overpaid by 5 billion euro for those loans because that's what the government basically told it to do. And it's interesting to hear yesterday Brendan McDonagh at the launch of their annual report, what would be their last annual report before they wound up. He was talking about the early days of NAMA, when they didn't have so much as a PC in the office. Staff were being taken from the National Treasury Management Agency and other places. They had to set up offices and do everything from absolute scratch. And of course, they had no experience of this type of work. I mean, nobody really did. So they got off to quite a slow start. They were very cautious for the first couple of years. But once they got into their stride, they began to work through these loans, and where the borrowers didn't repay or couldn't come to any agreement with them about a proper repayment schedule, they started to sell assets. Now, you'll recall at that time, there weren't many people in Ireland buying assets.
That's for sure.
Banks weren't lending to people to do it either. So most of those early asset sales were to overseas institutional investors, more commonly known in Ireland as vulture funds. Mm-hmm. But they were the only buyers, and they did get some cheap assets for sure. But the constant question, it's a slight counterfactual, is if NAMA hadn't sold those assets to those funds at that time, where would Ireland be now?
Well, a big question that was asked as well at the time is, like, would NAMA ever deliver a profit, ever? And I remember Minister Brian Lennon at the time saying that, like, NAMA could lead to a 5 billion euro profit at a time, John, when we had ghost estates, regular bank recapitalizations, and of course the country bailout in 2010. However, NAMA is on track to deliver a 5.5 billion euro profit. And every year of the years that NAMA has been in operation, except one, was profitable. So over the long term, has NAMA represented good value for taxpayers then?
Oh, it totally has. I think it's been a massive success story. And I think that's been more and more widely acknowledged as time goes on. And again, Susan, it's interesting to go back to 2009 and to look at some of the comments that were made at the time in relation to it. I mean, the whole concept of NAMA was criticized by everybody from the Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph Stiglitz to our own local economist David McWilliams, who I remember describing NAMA as highway robbery. And the future Taoiseach Leo Varadkar, who was then an opposition spokesman for finance, I think, he basically said this isn't going to work either. It won't get credit flowing. It's exposing taxpayers to all of the risk. Michael Summers, who was the chair of the NTMA, from which most of the staff, including Brendan McDonagh, came from, he seemed highly sceptical about it. And people in the Department of Finance thought it was going to end up making a loss. So that's what people were saying back in 2009. None of that came true. Nobody who made a bad prediction then has to pay any price for it. But luckily, the taxpayer isn't paying any price for NAMA.
Now, I also remember the letter that a range of economists sent in protest, you could say, to the whole idea at the time. And you've mentioned just the feeling around it. But it was a very, very contentious topic. And it wasn't just a contentious topic economically, but politically, as you've mentioned there as well, and socially, everybody was talking about this and continue to do so. So we've talked about the ultimate long-term success financially that has happened, but what criticisms have been levelled against NAMA over the years, John, and how valid were they?
So there's been a few different sets of criticisms. I mean, one is the lack of transparency, that there wasn't enough oversight over what NAMA was doing. There wasn't enough accountability. And that happens when you set up agencies or so-called quangos. They're not directly answerable to the public. They may come before an Oireachtas committee every now and again, but they just don't have the day-to-day accountability that politicians and ministers have, which is one of the reasons why these agencies are created on an arm's length basis. So that's probably fair enough. There is a criticism that they slightly sold assets too quickly at the beginning. They were a bit impatient. They should have taken longer. And as a result, they let certain things go too cheap. I think sometimes you can be a bit wise after the event. There's no question but that they did sell assets which were subsequently resold at multiples of their asking price. But on the other hand, some assets subsequently resold for less. So, but that was a criticism. And the other thing was, I mean, personalities did seem to come into it a bit. They didn't get on well with some of the developers that they were dealing with. The famous examples, I mean, he talked about it was Johnny Ronan. He and NAMA did not see eye to eye. Mm-hmm. They ended up in court. I mean, he basically bought his way out of NAMA or worked his way out of NAMA in the end, so that ended well. Harry Cosby wouldn't have a good word to say about NAMA either, you can be sure.
About Project Eagle?
Well, ultimately, I think they were pretty much vindicated on Project Eagle. So again, that came back to the criticism that they had let certain assets go too cheaply. But the finding there was that they didn't. There was no alternative buyer to Cerberus. As we said earlier, there weren't very many alternative buyers out there anyway. So there was some criticisms of how they handled it in terms of, again, transparency and their dealings with individual people. But that's not really a huge cloud over NAMA as it winds down this year either.
Well, can I pick up on the point particularly around speed? Not price, speed. Because if we look back over its history, like NAMA, first and foremost, it achieved its goals, but secondly, early. By 2017, it had enough cash to redeem all of its senior debt that was 30.2 billion.
March 2020, it was debt-free. And people may remember or forget this, that it actually injected $2 billion into state coffers at the time when we really needed it. Given the rise in asset prices since 2009, with the luxury of hindsight and with the knowledge that things rose probably faster than anyone could have, things being assets, the asset prices rose more than anybody could have anticipated at that period of time. Was the prioritisation of speed as decisions were being made the right thing to do?
I think it was, actually. You know, the alternative to NAMA was basically to nationalise the bank. So what they basically did instead was to nationalise the property market. So suddenly NAMA became the biggest operator of hotels in Ireland. I think it had something like 80 under its control. It became the biggest operator of golf courses in Ireland. It had, I think, 20 premium golf courses, plus all these apartment blocks and all these other assets. It had no experience of trying to manage these things. So it was right to get rid of some of them reasonably quickly. On the other side, they did restore market confidence in Ireland generally, as well as in the property market itself. Had these assets been hanging around for years while NAMA saw a slightly better price, it was just going to be bad for the image of Ireland. So they did basically stabilise the financial and the property market. And stabilisation, I think, in the Greece region, has to be done fairly quickly. You know, it's a process that needs to be tackled with some urgency.
Now, a lot of things were happening at the same time too. Like, you know, we saw the fall of interest rates in Europe, in ECB. We saw the declining value of the euro as a result, particularly of what was going on in Greece and other areas. We saw a rise in quantitative easing in the US. Like, there was a lot of other things going on as well. But one of the things that has happened over the period of NAMA's life is, of course, the housing crisis. And in the past 10 years, NAMA claims to have funded or facilitated the construction of over 37,000 homes in Ireland. And some of that was social housing. Now, in other cases, there were sales of development land to international funds who sat in it. You mentioned there the Vulture Funds, for example. How do you think history will write NAMA's role in addressing or adding to the housing crisis specifically, John?
Yeah, I think they will face criticism still over that. But to speak slightly in their favour again, they were only given the housing role about 6 years into their life. So they were set up with the remit of getting as much money back from the taxpayer as they possibly could. And then around 2015, everybody in Ireland woke up to the fact, hang on, we're going to face a huge housing shortage very quickly. We were all obsessed with ghost estates, and we realised that suddenly we're only building a couple of thousand houses a year. It's not going to be enough. And because NAMA still had control over so much land, so much zoned land, it was decided they should play a bigger role in it. And they did play a somewhat bigger role, but yeah, they could have done a lot more. What they've said, and I think it's valid, is, again, they didn't have much experience. Their senior people didn't have much experience of house building. And I think ultimately it was a better call to set up the LDA as we ultimately did. I know owner Brian Sinn Féin did make the interesting proposal that NAMA should have handed some of its land bank mm-hmm. straight to, say, Dublin City Council to let them build on it. That would have been fine, but that would have come at a big cost to the taxpayer as well.
And as we come to the end of this conversation, you picked up on his name earlier on, and I just want to ask you about the role of Brendan McDonagh, obviously a man who was in the news a couple of weeks ago for a housing reason. But looking back over the role that he has played in the entire legacy of NAMA and indeed of turning around that element of the industry, what's your take?
I think we've missed an opportunity in not having Brendan McDonagh as the so-called housing czar, because his record in NAMA is pretty good. It would have been interesting to see if he could have knocked heads together on housing and made a difference there. The reason he didn't get that job, Susan, as you know, or the reason why he decided to withdraw his name from consideration was because of a controversy over his salary. Now, since he was appointed the CEO of NAMA, his salary has been pretty constant around the 400,000 mark. It's currently €430,000, which is an enormous salary by everyday standards. There's no question about that. But nobody minded when he was getting that as the CEO of NAMA. Suddenly, even though it's a more complex job now to sort the Irish housing crisis, everybody had a massive problem with the idea that he was going to continue having that salary in that role. And as a result, you know, the controversy forced him to take a step back. I think it's interesting that he had the right to apply every year for a bonus in the legislation setting up NAMA. There was provision made for a bonus of up to 60% of his salary. So in theory, that could have been awarded every year. But every year he waived his right to be considered for that. So in theory, he left $2 million or more on the table that he didn't take. He didn't get any thanks for it when that controversy arose recently in relation to his salary. But he deserves a bit of credit for doing that.
Well, thank you very much indeed, John, for reeling in the ears with me there. And we're at a positive outcome. And so thanks indeed for joining me. John Burns, Deputy Business Editor with the Irish Independent. This is Susan Hayes-Cullerton here on Taking Stock on News Talk. And after the break, we ask, what's the economic impact of owning a pet? Now, you're welcome back to Taking Stock here on News Talk. I'm Susan Hayes-Cullerton, and usually during the show, I share some messages that people have sent in by email or social media. However, last Friday, got into a taxi and I could hear News Talk was on the radio, so I thought I'd do a bit of market research. And I said to the taxi driver, oh, is that the time? Kieran Godhi is on already. Do you usually listen to News Talk? At which he said, now, do you work in radio or do you just listen to it? I'm sure, of course, I couldn't lie to the man and my cover was blown. So, when you hear me doing proactive market research, feel free to call me out on it. I also want to thank Aidan for his email last week and his comments about the style of questions that I ask. And we received a note last week from Adele after the disabilities conversation with Elaine Teagan and Bobby Hickey. And she mentioned that CPL and IBEC were commissioned by Japan's Ministry of Health, Labour and Welfare to organise a trip inviting participants from developed countries, including Ireland, to visit and attend a programme, including lectures and discussions on Japan's latest legal frameworks and corporate practices related to the employment of persons with disabilities. And I just wanted to share that with you because I think it's really important just to look at how Ireland is handling this issue and how it's looking around the world and really engaging with some best practices. And we'll be interested to see where that goes. Now, well, I'm sure you've noticed that pets are not just pets anymore. They're now seen as quasi-human, and now an integral part of the family. And this includes taking up a hefty piece of expenditure for their owners as well. Now, the pets as family sentiment in Ireland is among the strongest in the world. So when did this start and what does this mean for us? So Charles Cosgrove from Village Vets is with me now. First of all, Charles, you're very welcome to Taking Stock.
Thanks a million for having me, Susan. Glad to be here.
Now, we have in Ireland 500,000 dogs and 355,000 cats in the country. And Pet Mania tells us that we spend around about €2,000 per month on our fur babies. Now, Charles, I can imagine telling my granddad Hayes in Timmy League in West Cork that he was a dog daddy back in the day. Like, when did this trend really start?
Yeah, look, it's been great. It's been gradually creeping up on us. I suppose, you know, it's sort of the evolution of pet ownership in Ireland as, you know, as we moved from a more agricultural economy to a more sort of urban economy and more service-based, pets have become less of a working pet or working animal on a farm and become more domestic pets and companion pets. So, you know, being in our house more, you know, going for walks and sort of more activity-based for us as companions rather than sort of out on a farm. And certainly that was really turbocharged in COVID when we were all working from home and we became closer to our pets. They become more important members of the family. And it's been a more upper trajectory in that sense ever since then.
And I see here 75% of people celebrate their pet's birthday and 90% of pet owners include their pets into Christmas festivities. Now, I can tell you, Charles, at home, Santa always came to our dog cell at home every year, independent of the age she got to. But I presume it's a good thing that people are taking their pet ownership as pet ownership and family ownership to this extent.
Absolutely, Susan. Like, you know, we go back 10 years, 15 years, the euthanasia rate in dog pounds was massive. You know, there's an awful lot of stray dogs, an awful lot of dogs that never got rehomed. And we have come on a monumental journey as pet owners in the Irish sort of culture, and it's been phenomenal and it's been great, and pets are been taken care of more. You know, they are part of the family. Absolutely, everyone, you know, it would be, you know, Santa letters get written for pets. They're, you know, the screensavers on our phones, they're on our social media profiles, they're in our WhatsApp profile pictures. So it really is that they are really an integral part of the family, and that comes with huge benefits and also huge responsibilities.
Well, Can I also talk about the risk as well? Because in terms of pet insurance, about 30% of pet owners have pet insurance in Ireland. Now, when I heard that statistic first, I didn't have a frame of reference to compare it to. So I went looking. And it's actually, that 30% figure is much lower than in the UK, but much, much lower than in Sweden. In Sweden, it's 90%. So what's your thoughts on the importance of taking out pet insurance? Like, should pet owners do it?
Yeah, pet insurance is really, it kind of gives you comfort when it comes to any sort of serious injury or serious illness. And while 30% would be a low figure, it's come it's a low figure by international standards. It is growing year on year within Ireland. And we've got to take it into context. And you're quite right when you say we're lower than the UK or Sweden, but in sort of pet care terms or veterinary terms, those economies would be a lot more advanced in their veterinary care. And as a result, the price of the veterinary care in the UK and in Scandinavian countries is far in excess of what it is here in Ireland. So the veterinary care can be quite expensive, but in Ireland, it is a lot more affordable than it is in the UK or Scandinavia. So hence, pet insurance has a higher penetration rate in those countries.
Well, actually, it also has a higher claim rate as well, Charles. As I looked into it, 30% of pet policies are claimed, and that's much higher, say, than 15% for home insurance or 22% for motor insurance. But can you educate us, myself included, on the types of things that one would claim for? Like, what today can veterinary do that it couldn't do before?
Yeah, well, if you look at the pets are, I suppose, when less claims are taken out on houses and cars, they're more of a controlled entity in the sense that they don't run off. They don't jump off your couch or your run down the stairs or jump out in front of cars or trip over themselves or get into dogfights. So that's a lot of where claims come from getting into skirmishes with other dogs in the park, getting off lead and getting knocked by a car. We see a lot of cats falling off balconies and apartments, dogs jumping off stairs erratically. And then also on the illness side of things, you see a lot of vomiting, a lot of diarrhea, a lot of skin issues, and then you also get internal illnesses such as heart disease, kidney disease, diabetes, liver issues. So there's a multitude of health conditions that can be, quite ongoing, become chronic conditions, or become quite severe quite quickly. And that's when, when it comes to treating them or trying to manage them, it can become quite expensive quite quickly.
And all of those, of course, are things that can go wrong. But when we look at what's going right, I have to ask you about like doggy daycare, pet spas, regular grooming. Where is this going, Charles, in the amount of luxury, we'll say, or the treats that people are buying for pets now? Is there more of a, well, obviously there's more of a market for it, but is the market looking for more and more nice things to do for their pets?
Yeah, I think that goes with the sort of dehumanization of pets, or I'm going to pronounce this, Susan, so bear with me, but the anthropomorphism of pets. So anthropomorphism is the technical term for dehumanization of pets. But yeah, absolutely. I think, as pets are, sitting on the couch beside us as we watch TV at nighttime, and they're coming in car journeys with us and they're our companion when we go on walks, they have adapted a very important place within the family, and as such then they get treated like another family member. So everything from your Christmas presents right through to regular grooming, really high quality boarding kennels if we have to leave them somewhere when we go on holidays. And then that extends itself into veterinary care, where the type of care that people are looking to provide their pets now has become hugely sophisticated. And me as a vet and working with the rest of the vets and village vets, there is an expectation from pet owners that they want a higher level of care akin to the same amount of care that they have themselves. And that has come on leaps and bounds in recent years. So, for example, you can now come in to a veterinary clinic and in the morning time with quite a sick pet, and you can have blood tests and tests done on site with AI interpretation or manual interpretation, have those results back within half an hour, 60 minutes. You can then proceed to have an ultrasound or an x-ray scan or even a CT scan and have those results back by lunchtime. At that point, you have a diagnosis. You may proceed for surgery and have the surgery, potentially life-saving or life-altering surgery, that same day and have a very positive clinical resolution to a severe illness or injury, all within 24 hours. And that was unheard of 10 years ago. So that's the progress. And it has been huge in healthcare for pets over that period of time. And that's that trajectory will continue along the same lines as humans.
Now, I'm not going to try and pronounce that term you gave me there for the humanization. But another term that I want to bring up to you that that I would normally think about as humans is geriatric. And when I think about, we had Cell at Home for 16 years, and 16 years was a really good long time that we had with her. Now, my mum would have held on to her forever, as you could imagine, Charles. But we got 16 really great years from Cell. But at that point, of course, she was an older dog. And are dogs living longer now, and cats, with this type of care? And is there geriatric pet care?
Absolutely, yeah. And look, 16 is a great age, there's no doubt about it. But pets absolutely are living longer, and they're living longer but healthier. So those, you know, as we are with humans, you know, we are living longer too, and we are more active in our latter years. So I look at my dad, who's in his 70s, and he's a lot healthier than what my grandfather would have been at his age. So it's definitely the same with pets as well. So, you know, with sort of geriatric care, a lot of the common illnesses and injuries that pets have would be along the lines of diabetes, heart failure, kidney issues, liver issues, and also arthritis. And the treatments available nowadays to treat all those issues in pets are really advanced. So we're keeping pets healthier for longer and able to manage those conditions without them becoming overly sick or overly in pain or discomfort. And that's phenomenal. Like, even for arthritis, there's phenomenal drugs out there now available that keep pets pain-free for an awful lot longer than we would have done years ago. So yeah, geriatric care has come on in leaps and bounds and is a big component of pet healthcare.
But that's such a positive thing, isn't it? I mean, you talk about, as you say, people sitting down on the couch with their pets or bringing them in the car, etc. I was just thinking the other day, I was in Milan this time last year for work, and I remember I had to get my nails done, and I noticed a lot of people bringing their pets into the salon. There was dogs and cats, and more today we see like pet-friendly cafes and accommodation. Do you see is there more to run here, Charles, or are we at peak pet?
I think that really where we see, there's been a lot of research done on the human-animal bond. And, you know, if you Google that, there's actually a Human-Animal Bond Institute that sort of do scientific research on how the benefits of pet ownership are, and they're to humans. And they're hugely beneficial, you know, to reducing stress, encouraging people to exercise more, and the link, and even being a sort of a companion to people who maybe live on their own or have had a partner recently deceased. And the benefits of that are huge. And there's been oodles of research done in that, and especially in sort of in elderly communities or assisted living communities, where pets are becoming more and more integrated into those communities, whereas years ago you wouldn't dream of ever bringing a pet into that environment, where now it's sort of becoming sort of an act of encouragement because of the positive benefits. So are we reaching peak pet? I think we've a long way to go yet. I think there's a lot more benefits. I think if you look at the European countries, where there's probably a more open environment or a more open culture to having pets in food producing areas like cafes and restaurants, I think as an Irish culture, or maybe it's around the rules that restaurants and cafes are governed by, but I think we still have a journey to go there.
Well, in line with that then, there's likely a business opportunity in meeting that demand as well. In terms of spending, Charles, interestingly, Americans spent more last year on their pets than on childcare. And Mars, so the minute I say that company, of course, people will probably think of the Mars bar. So yes, you're right. That is the company I'm talking about. Mars made about 2/3 of their revenue from pet care last year, and Nestle and Colgate make about 1/5 of their revenue from pet divisions. Is there Is there a clarion call here to businesses who are interested in this area to say, look, you know, get your thinking hats on, get innovative. People want this. This is a growing market and it's an area that is inelastic. People will spend on their pets and they'll cut spending on their pets slower than they would in other areas.
Yeah, look, I think pets being part of the family is here to stay. It's not going to go away. And, you know, that's probably going to become more pronounced and more obvious as the years go by. And I think absolutely, you know, businesses are constantly evolving. You know, we evolved to the horrible years of COVID, and you know, there's been a lot of positive stuff on the back of that. You know, with outdoor alfresco dining and that type of thing. I think that will. We need to evolve. A lot of businesses need to evolve to accommodate pets and families having pets and making themselves more attractive to that market. So, you know, in America, you know, I think that the pet ownership has now overtaken families with children. And that has skewed the dynamic then in terms of what people want, how they shop, where they go on holidays. And, you know, you'll see it here. There's lots of hotels that are pet friendly and that continues to grow. That list of hotels continues to grow. So I think absolutely as businesses become more savvy, they will adapt to that market.
Charles Cosgrove from Village Vets, thanks so much indeed for joining me there. I'm sure you have warmed the hearts of lots and lots of our listeners. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Susan.
Well, that's it for this week's Taking Stock with me, Susan Hayes-Cullerton. I really hope you enjoyed the show and that you learned something about economics and how it affects our world. So I'll just remind you, the show is available as a podcast first on Friday mornings on the News Talk app or wherever you get your podcasts. And of course, make sure to subscribe to the show while you're there. Now, it's also on the radio every Sunday morning at 9 a.m. The producer of Taking Stock is John Fardy, and on research this week was Simon Keane and Stephen Daunt. Hugo De Silva Scott was on sound. Thank you so much indeed for listening and enjoy the rest of your day. And I look forward to chatting to you next week.